It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later on in the hour, we'll hear from a Wisconsin school superintendent about referenda on the ballot tomorrow that would support the idea of additional tax dollars to support school operations. First, though, much has been said about how a lack of parental involvement can't affect children. But what if parents are too involved? What if they're too attuned to their kids?
Author Hannah Rosen recently wrote a piece on overprotected kids in the Atlantic that caught her eye. She took a close look at children's playgrounds and found that fears over safety makes many American playgrounds boring to kids and, in a sense, robs them of an opportunity to explore their creativity, their independence, and sense of adventure. Hannah Rosen joins us now to share more about the importance of allowing children to face challenging situations. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
A lot of parents today, including yourself, remember vastly different childhood experiences than their own children have. I, for instance, remember raiding this plastic factory and getting gobs of hardened plastic and trying to melt it down and running through strangers' garages, being out until dark. How different is that childhood culture is it today from what it used to be when parents today were growing up?
Well, your memories are very similar to mine, and that's in fact why I wrote this story, because I remembered my own childhood so differently from the way my kids are being raised that I actually thought I might be making it up. You know, was it true that I spent all those hours by myself and that my mother wasn't always watching me or that I was running around the neighborhood? There were no such things as play dates. And, you know, I think a lot of people my age who are raising children now have that feeling. They sort of understand their childhoods were different, but they don't know exactly why or how that happened.
Well, one thing that happened is it seemed like the parenting culture and culture at large began to get more fearful. There began to be more anxiety about accidents and stranger danger. When did that start to take root?
It started in about the late 70s or the early 80s, and that's one thing I do in this article is track which cases and how it came to be and how stranger danger got to infect our minds. I mean, the irony, as I write, is that there actually isn't a much greater chance of a child being abducted now than there was in the 70s, and yet we feel that there must be. We feel very afraid, even though there isn't actually any statistical reason to feel more afraid now than when we were children.
So you're saying that the world is not more dangerous now than it was when we were kids?
No, much less so. I mean, we've been going through a real crime decline, especially lately. I think the world is very different than when we were kids, but it's not more dangerous. It's different in the sense that neighborhoods don't have the cohesion that they used to. There aren't, for example, a lot of mothers around in the neighborhood. A lot more mothers work. And there isn't a sense that neighborhoods are knitted together and that if you're not directly watching your child, somebody else in the neighborhood would be. So things have changed. They just haven't changed in exactly the way we think they have.
So what happened? There were just a bunch of high-profile cases that were maybe horrific but not very common, and everyone just kind of freaked out?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's basically what happened, is that there were a lot of cases, like the ones that I write about. They got a lot more media attention than they used to. And as I said, we had this vague sense that something had changed. You know, in the 70s was the era of the divorce boom. You know, we had a sense that families were coming apart, that neighborhoods were coming apart. And so what we did is kind of, that's a hard thing to get your head around. That's a very big and vague fear. So what we did is kind of localize it onto something manageable, which was stranger danger. You know, if you let your kid walk down the street, somebody's going to snatch them, which is a horrible thing that you can't get out of your head, you know, once it's happened to someone you know or you see it in the news, but it's really, really, really unlikely.
So part of it is that, the fear of abduction, but part of it is, you know, the playgrounds themselves changed almost overnight, it seems like, from these places that were a little bit edgy and where a kid could kind of challenge themselves a bit to everything being standardized and plastic coated and rubberized. What about that?
Yeah, so I write about a lawsuit that happened in the late 70s where a kid fell off a slide. And again, this was the era when we were kind of primed to be nervous. And so that got a lot of publicity, and states became nervous about being sued. There came to be regulations that were passed to govern how playgrounds should be built. And I think what happened over time is the culture became afraid of letting their children take any risks. In other words, you know, we just felt that it was our job as parents always to be protecting our child, that that was the prime purpose of a parent. And I think what happened as a result of that, without our intending it to, is that we prevent our children from taking any risks. You know, we think that, you know, any emotional or physical risks are too much for them to bear.
And for this piece, you sort of tracked a new movement that seems to be getting some traction, at least in Britain, maybe in the U.S. as well. But you went to a playground in the U.K. where the kids basically had free range. They started fires, they played in a creek, they swung on ropes. Can you tell us about that playground and the philosophy behind it?
Yes, it's called an adventure playground, or some people call them junk playgrounds, and they're actually modeled after junkyards. They were quite common in the 40s after the war, and then they were kind of in keeping with the cultural norms of the time. That is, you know, you wanted your kids to grow up to be brave and take risks. And they really look like a junkyard. I mean, you've got tools all around and the kids build fires. That's the thing that catches most people's attention. I mean, they're literally taught how to build fires. And there aren't any parents around. That's the other interesting thing. The kids come and go on their own. What there are people called play workers who are, you know, adults who are kind of lightly supervising what's going on without really intervening. And I went there just as a kind of shock therapy. You know, I start my story that way, just as a way of showing people there is a whole other way for children to be. And they believe very much that, you know, children should be able to take these risks, because in taking these risks, they learn to conquer them. And that's what growing up means. You know, that's how you slowly come to trust yourself, know your own limits. The kids kind of travel in packs there the way we used to. And so that's the way you learn to kind of negotiate with other children and find your place in the pack. And so all the things that, you know, used to be natural markers of growing up, which don't actually happen anymore just because child culture is so extinct now.
And one theory is that by testing yourself, or maybe even falling off a piece of equipment and bonking your head, you get sort of inoculated against something that might grow into an anxiety later on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, this is where you're taking a leap here, but there is all the talk one hears about the millennials. You know, they're not independent enough. Their studies show that creativity and the ability to think outside the box has gone down over the last 10, 15 years. And so one theory is maybe they haven't been allowed to take the risks that are necessary in order to grow and know yourself and trust yourself. And so one researcher I quote, you know, her study is about how when a child needs to feel like they're taking a risk and conquering it, that isn't to say that they need to do something dangerous, but they need to feel that they're doing something dangerous. Like, oh, I'm going to try and climb a little higher than I thought I was capable of, and then I'll master that, and then I'll feel really proud of myself, and sort of on and on through the stages. So it used to be, you know, you would wait for your mother to give you permission to ride your bicycle to your friend's house, or, you know, to ride your bicycle across the street to your friend's house, and there would be little markers for a third grader, a fifth grader, a seventh grader, and they would be signs that you were growing up and could trust yourself. She even writes, this researcher, about getting lost and how important that is for children, that thrill of kind of, oh my gosh, I'm out of sight of my parents, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to save this situation? So again, not actually being in dangerous situations, but feeling inside them that they are solving problems for themselves.
We're talking right now with Hannah Rosen, national correspondent for The Atlantic and the author of the book The End of Men. We'll continue our conversation about the virtues of a wild childhood. We're talking with Hannah Rosen, national correspondent for The Atlantic, talking about how overprotecting kids might affect their development and their creativity and their ability to believe in themselves and overcome things.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. What was your childhood like? Did you have a great time as a child exploring out of the eyesight of your parents, nearly not knowing what was going on? But then, as a parent yourself, how do you feel about that? How do you protect your kids and yet not hurt their development and creativity? What kind of line do you have to walk there? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@WPR.org.
Do you think there would be a benefit to letting your children have a wild childhood, maybe more like your own? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And we were talking about the playgrounds, and you visited, Hannah, some adventure playgrounds in the U.K., and there was later on in America a book of guidelines for playground safety, and it sort of turned the tide on what playgrounds looked like. What kinds of playgrounds did the guidelines bring about? What did they turn into here?
At first, the guidelines were fairly general in the 1980s. They had kind of common sense suggestions. You know, don't make holes in bars that a kid's head can get stuck in. You know, just kind of general guidelines like that. And over time, like many other things, they became very, very specific and designed more for manufacturers and without kind of children's play and adventure in mind. So, it, you know, they were designed in order to make it easy to be able to have interchangeable playground parts here, Sweden, you know, Wisconsin, Seattle, sort of wherever you go, you could see the same kind of playground, and it could be interchangeable, and also designed to prevent lawsuits. So nobody wanted nobody wanted to be sued and have those instructions read, even though they're not mandatory, they're suggestions. Nobody wanted any parent to bring those suggestions into a courtroom and say, look, they're not following the guidelines. And so it all became about not being sued and easily manufactured.
Now, it's one thing to talk about missing a wild childhood like you and me might have had, but there are some researchers who say that, for instance, kids today are not as creative on lots of different measures as they used to be back when playgrounds were more adventurous. Can you talk about some of that research?
Yes, I just think we've taken it a little bit too far, that kids are less. There is something called a creativity scale where they measure, you know, sort of original thoughts. They give a series of questions. They've been doing it for a very long time. And in the last 10 years, kids have shown to be lower on the creativity scale. There's also evidence of depression. You know, a lot of, we read a lot about millennials coming in, or it's pretty young millennials, I would say, post-college kind of drift, not really knowing how to take care of themselves and not expecting bad things to happen. I mean, it's not so much that they're crippled as that when things are drifty or not set or they have to rely on themselves, they feel a little at sea. You know, so and as we all know, that's just a part of life, that will happen in life, that you will feel at sea. So you have to expect that to happen. And that's something you learn to depend on yourself early in childhood. And I don't think the answer, by the way, is to go back to the 70s. I'm not advocating that we let our children run free. I think it's nice that we have close connections with our children. I think it's more about giving a little breathing space and maybe reconceiving the role of a parent so that you're not always saying, my number one job as a parent is to protect my child from the possibility of emotional and physical harm. What you're more saying to yourself is, maybe one of my jobs as a parent is to create opportunities for my child to explore and get to know themselves. So that kind of becomes part of the job description of the parent.
And let's go to our phone lines now. We have Don joining us from Ontario. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to agree with your guest. I mean, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and things were pretty wide open for kids. I mean, we'd be sometimes on our bikes, for instance, for, you know, like 8 in the morning till 10 at night or something. But I had to disagree a little about the world being more dangerous or not. I was talking to your screener a minute ago about I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, for instance, and Trenton always had parts that were bad, but not that many. And now I think it would be pretty dangerous to walk around like much of that city. And I think there's a lot of places that have made that same evolution, and it's not a good one.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Don. And what about his take that maybe things are changing for the worse and we do need to be more watchful?
Well, the one good piece of news here is that things are changing for the worse in society, meaning?
Don has dropped off, but I'm assuming he means, you know, in essence, there maybe is more crime and more things to be wary of.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't. I don't know what to say. I mean, crime has gone through a nosedive in the 90s, crimes against children, crimes against everyone. And the kinds of crimes that parents have in mind, like a stranger abducting your child, they just haven't gone up. I don't know what to say. I mean, you can measure these things. There are FBI crime statistics. There are people who watch these things. They're extremely rare. What has gone up is divorce and therefore fathers snatching their children. I mean, I write this in the story, like, if you really want to keep your child from getting abducted, you should say, don't talk to your father, not don't talk to a stranger, because what has gotten more likely is that in a divorce case, a father who wants to but cannot see his children because of some court proceeding, takes a child, and that's what happens. It's generally somebody the child knows, not a stranger.
All right. Well, thank you, Don, for the call. Next to Katie in Bayfield. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I was just calling to kind of throw another perspective in. I'm, I guess, on the later end of the millennials. I just turned 29 yesterday, and I was raised way up north, Bayfield, Wisconsin, with a lot more freedom. Like, I thought, like, I was pretty wild and free, typical story of the 8 a.m. out, not home till dark, And I know a lot of, like, that was how all of my siblings and cousins and friends, we were all raised in that same way, thinking we were really wild and free, but realizing now as an adult, it was our community's responsibility to keep us safe. Really tight-knit community, and I'm realizing as I'm raising my kids now that though they do tend to go out and they get to spend a lot of time out and about, they still, we rely upon ourselves, upon, you know, my kids' aunties, or we know where the kids are, wherever they're at. My son's only about 8 years old, but I can trust him to do what he needs to do.
So you said you relied on your community growing up. Can you describe your community? What was that like?
Well, I was born and raised on a reservation. And so, I mean, my next door neighbor was my best friend, but also my cousin, and her dad was my dad's cousin. I mean, we were all super close. We lived in a small little housing area, but, you know, as long as we were in that housing area, we knew our boundaries, where we were supposed to go, when we were supposed to be back. And as you got older, you were allowed to go a little further, go farther out, go, you know, okay, you can go to the next housing area, or you can go farther a mile down and go to the store and back, or we have woods, I mean, in conjunct to every almost house I've ever lived in, and wandered around playing where we could when we could.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Katie. Thanks for telling us about that. And it sounds like what you're saying, hon, is that the one thing that's changed is maybe communities aren't as tightly knit, and maybe you don't have all the eyes in the community feeling, watching your kid instead of just you being responsible. But what do you think when you hear Katie?
Yeah, I think that is true. That is the big change, is that, you know, moms particularly are not around. But what happens is then we exaggerate the problem and make it worse. Like, over time, as that started to happen, we've then fully conceived of the public space as very dangerous. And so we make it worse, you know, because we sort of give momentum to this idea of there being no knitting in a community. Like, I honestly think, you know, if your child learned to say hello to the neighbors, that would be better. You know, make an effort, in other words, for your child to get to know, to have a sense of a public space as safe, at least your community and the people around you and the people they know, that we started to think of that as a kind of valid space for your child, as opposed to the only safe places in their own bedroom.
Honey, you talked about how you think maybe the takeaway from this is that not that parents should let their kids just be free range and have run of the place, but to create opportunities for them to experience some of these risk-taking moments. How would you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, there's very simple things like leave your child alone on the playground. I mean, then you see this routinely as children, as parents who just follow their child around everywhere, go down with them on the slide, or sort of terrified of their child doing anything on their own. Think about, you know, if you live close by, what age your child can walk to school by themselves. One of the statistics in my story is how in the 1970s, something like 85% of third graders walked to school on their own. Now it's down to 4%. I mean, there's really no reason for that. Like, I live, you know, three blocks away. And part of this is social sanction. Like, if I let my third grader walk to school, then all the other parents will think I'm nuts. But there's a stream of children walking down the hill to the school in the morning before school time. There really is no reason why they can't walk to school on their own. So just try and think of ways to kind of, you know, to sort of switch that social pressure a little bit, so that kids are allowed to do a little bit on their own and that parents don't feel like they have to intervene at every moment.
All right, let's try to get one more call in. Tim joins us now from Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I was raised with a very wild childhood. I'm 29. I'm currently going to college, and none of the people who I go to school with can take care of themselves. Because of that, my kids are allowed to have fun. They're allowed to walk to the park, and I'm not tying into what the media has to say when they freak out about every little thing that happens. You know, child abduction, they don't happen at a higher rate. We just report on them at a higher rate.
All right. Well,
so I'm not worried about it.
And Tim giving his kids a little bit of what he had when he was younger. What do you think of that approach, Hannah?
I think that's great. I mean, I think it's nice to start keeping that in mind. Since I've written this article, I run into lots of moms, and I feel like I've gotten so many pictures actually from children saying, thank you, my mom let me in the backyard build my own fort. So I've got an inbox full of pictures of forts, you know, where the mom just sort of stayed in the kitchen and let the kids kind of be outside without sitting with them or checking on them every second, and they got to, you know, do the stuff that we used to do.
Do you see the U.S. moving in this direction now? Is it time?
I think there is a little bit of shakeup. It does give me hope. I live in Washington, D.C., and we just got our first awesome playground, you know, one that where kids of all ages sort of love to play, and things are pretty high, and there's a zip line, and it's in a private school, but they leave it open for the community on the weekends, and it apparently took a lot of effort to get that playground passed without parents really worrying about the safety. It's a wonderful place, and it's utterly packed on the weekends, and you can see that kids are starving for such a place that just looks like a big Adventureland. I mean, it's not an adventure playground like the one I wrote about, but it really does seem exciting for kids. So I think there is a sense in which, you know, we all talk about helicopter parenting and overprotecting and millennials being depressed. I mean, this is very much in the culture right now. So I feel like the more we talk about it, the more people will get the message and start to ease off just a little bit.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today, Hannah. Appreciate your time.
Thanks.
That was Hannah Rosen, national correspondent for The Atlantic. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a member of the trans community about Transgender Day of Visibility. It's being celebrated today.
First, some voters in Wisconsin are going to the polls tomorrow to vote on whether to increase property taxes to maintain regular operations in their school districts.
The 26 school districts are asking to raise property taxes above the state set limit. And they're not out to fund new projects. They just want to keep what they have in place.
Many of the primarily rural school districts say they've already used any budget flexibility provided to them by Act 10 and now face layoffs and cuts to programs. Here with us to talk about tomorrow's referenda is Superintendent of the Oakfield School District in Fond du Lac County, Sue Green. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So 26 districts we're talking about tomorrow are going to be putting it to the voters to raise taxes to pay for school operations. How big does that number seem to you?
It's awfully big number. We have a lot of districts that are going through exactly what we are going through, really facing some difficult challenges on funding our schools and keeping our district afloat.
And why would you say this is such a widespread issue? Why has it come to a head right now?
Mm-hmm. In the 1993-94 school year, Wisconsin changed the way that they funded the schools. And we are seeing more and more districts that can't make ends meet because of the change in the school funding.
Now, the Walker administration intended Act 10 to help give school districts flexibility to make up budget shortfalls through, for instance, pension negotiations or teacher salaries. What about those mechanisms? Did they work?
Well, we certainly made a significant number of cuts in both of those areas since last year. Last spring, the Oakfield School District had a referendum, the same referendum that had failed. And as a result of that, for this school year, they had to make significant cuts in staffing. We have made major changes in the insurance and benefits packages for all teachers. Our staff are kind of working on a bare-bones kind of budget. Our staff this year are under a salary freeze. So we have made significant cuts.
So you're saying the tools were there and you use them and it's still not cutting it?
Correct.
What about funding from the state? Where does that stand?
It is, you know, what it has been for the last number of years, and that formula is very complex. It is really hurting the small school districts, and we are hoping that the state will take a look at what's happening to the small rural school districts.
Is the cost of educating students going up?
Well, I think the cost of everything is continually going up. There isn't a change necessarily in that way, but so many things that are a part of your school budget have gone up significantly. The biggest part of any school budget is your entire pay for your staffing and the benefits. And the benefits, the cost of insurance for everyone, whether you're working in a school district or a private venue, those are quite high and continuing to rise, and causing a lot of difficulties for everyone in the employer's seat. We are looking at just the cost of everything, the cost of fuel, the cost for transportation. They all impact us such a great deal.
Now, there are caps that are in place for property tax hikes for schools to increase revenue. So how hard a sell is this going to be, this referenda?
Well, I think what we're saying is that we want everything to stay the same way that it is. And to do that, looking at what we have for our enrollment and what we're projecting for the next couple of years, we need the support directly from our taxpayers. And so we are asking for, ours is a six-year referendum, which is, I think, on the part of our school board, a pretty courageous step to take to look out that far out in the future and say this is what we need, 3 years with $1 million increase. And then the following three years would be a $1.2 million increase.
Now, this is your second year going to the taxpayers themselves, right? What happened last year?
Yes, it is. I was not here last spring. I came on board July 1st of this year. So I'm only looking at what I understand happened in the district. I think that overall there was a feeling that it wasn't as dire and that there still could be a lot more cuts to be made. So when it failed last spring, the school board and the administration made the significant cuts they needed to get through this school year. And it was very painful to the district, to the community. There were a lot of individuals who had their positions cut and a great deal of cutbacks in what we're able to do as a school district.
How much is your school district asking to raise this time around?
We are asking for a six-year referendum, $1 million a year for 3 years, and then for the next 3 years, a $1.2 million a year.
And flesh that out a little bit for us. What exactly would that be going to pay for?
It's continually a part of our operations. So it supports the current funding that we get from the state, and it allows us to keep all of our programs and staffing right at the point that we're at. And we feel that we're doing a great job. We have an excellent academic record. We do well on the state report card, on our state assessments, and we're considered by so many in the area as a school district of choice. We have a very high open enrollment, people that want this kind of an environment to educate their children. And so we're looking at maintaining everything that we have and not being forced to make any additional cuts.
Well, let's say tomorrow rolls around and the referendum doesn't pass. Taxpayers don't want to increase revenue for the schools by raising their taxes. What are the ramifications? What happens at your school next year?
Mm-hmm. We know that we would begin the process of, again, significant cuts, and this time it will be more of the specific programming options that are available at
like
a secondary
what?
Level, like your agriculture, your technology, things that are not absolutely required for a graduation, but give a student options and a well-rounded choice for a child's future.
What about arts programs, say?
The arts program, all of them would be on the line.
Mm-hmm. And teachers' jobs, what about those?
Again, we would have to look at that. It's that's what it's going to have to come to so that we could maintain and function one more year.
And is it possible that the school itself could close?
That is very possible. Right now, we estimate that we have funding to get through the good part of next year, and that is based on the projections for how many students we currently have enrolled. Our fear is that if the referendum does not pass, we would have students, families making the decision to open enroll and go to a nearby district rather than wait for the end of the school district. We really do see it as a very dire situation if it does not pass.
It seems common so far, just looking at the track record, that these kinds of referenda are not passed. You're one of 26 rural schools who are looking to raise revenue through tax hikes. I wonder, what do you think is at stake, especially as regards rural schools, if this trend continues and maybe these referenda continue to have trouble passing?
Mm-hmm. I guess that's a very good question for the lawmakers in the state of Wisconsin, the Department of Public Instruction, to look at what's happening to something that's been a backbone in the state of Wisconsin, that we have a variety of sizes of school districts and many families opt for the small, intimate, rural school setting where all of the children know each other, the families know one another, the staff know the families extremely well. It's a very close-knit community, and there's a great deal of pride in the children and the school district.
Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sue Green, superintendent of the Oakfield School District in Fond du Lac County. Voters around the state will head to the polls tomorrow to decide whether to raise taxes to fund regular operating costs in at least 26 rural school districts.
Today, March 31st, is Transgender Visibility Day. It's a day to recognize the trans people in our community. And joining us now is Catherine Kimford, a member of the trans community and an LGBT activist. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start out with some basic definitions, just so we're all on the same page with what we're talking about. What is the definition of a transgender person?
Well, you really break down the word trans, meaning crossing over a boundary, gender. And now gender being different from sex in that sex is a physical characteristic. Gender is a psychological, a cultural characteristic. So you put the words together, transgender is kind of a very broad term to describe anyone for whom the original assignment they were given at birth, whether it was male or female, that does not fully describe their life, their identity, whether it's someone who feels they embody characteristics of both genders or whether it's someone who physically crosses over to live a life as a gender opposite what they were assigned at birth.
Right. And that those two words, that transgender, transsexual, are often, I think, and you should tell me if I'm seeing this correctly, but they're often sort of used, you know, in place of each other in everyday conversation by most people who don't understand that distinction.
Right. Transsexual is specifically talking about the physical transition.
Mm-hmm.
So people who go through hormone treatments, surgical treatments to make their bodies conform to their identity. Transgender is a broader term. Just encompasses more people because there are a lot of ways to identify.
So let's talk a little bit about why you're here today. Today is March 31st. It is Transgender Day of Visibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a holiday I think a lot of people have heard of. It's relatively new. And what are you trying to do? What's the purpose of this?
Well, there's a lot of things to accomplish. It's a day to just kind of celebrate who we are, what we have, our place in the world, our place in the community. Just, you know, we've done a lot of good things, a lot of famous things that a lot of people don't know about. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the general community not familiar with transgender people. And just taking a day to be out there, to put ourselves like, hey, look at us. This is who we are. Just kind of join the world.
So in terms of that holiday, how do you think, I mean, it's only been underway for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there has been, have you noticed in your community that there's been some effectiveness here, that there is a rising level of awareness about transgender, the role that it plays in the community and various communities, I should say, around the state?
Definitely each year it is getting better. I haven't seen, I mean, it's too much of a new holiday. There hasn't been too much specific Transgender Day of Visibility mm-hmm. observances, but I have seen just even in the last 10 years a big jump in awareness overall.
So how do people who are trans or who are trans allies celebrate this particular day?
Well, there's a lot of this holiday started online is how the word got out. So I know there's a lot of just posts on social media. That's kind of how I have been observing the holiday the past few years. There's also, especially around Michigan where it started and in the Bay Area where there's a huge flourishing LGBT community. And even around the world, I know Dublin has, I saw on the Transgender Day of Visibility page, has some festival going on. So there are community events. There are not a lot of them yet, but it's filling a need. The holiday is filling a need the trans community's had for a while. So it is gaining steam. I think in the next few years we'll see more.
So let's talk about that need. What is it precisely that when you talk about needs, are you talking about misconceptions, the need to increase visibility, or all of those things?
I think the two are kind of tied together. There are a lot of misconceptions. So often in the media, you see transgender characters that are either inaccurate, they're put in for comedic effect, or they're put in and they're really drag queens is what they're portraying. And we're just ordinary people that happen to have this interesting bit to our history, and we are in all walks of life. I think there's misconceptions that for male to female transgender people that, you know, we're kind of hyper feminized, that we're not going to be interested in sports or have relationships with women, or, you know, play, you know, be auto mechanics or grill out on the 4th of July. You know, we do all those things. I mean, it doesn't change who we are because we have this one element of our history.
So what other misconceptions are there? Are there, you know, one of the misconceptions that occurs to me is that the idea of transgender has been around for a really long time. And some people might be thinking, well, you know, this is only something that's popped up in the last 10 or 15 years. And I suspect that just isn't the case.
It goes back much further than that. Cultures, aside from kind of our American westernized culture, there's a two-spirit identity in many Native American tribes. There's third gender identities in several other Eastern places. I'm blanking on some of the specifics. But even within Western culture, transgender people have been around. They haven't had the medical resources to do the transition, the physical element we have today. But there have been, it's a centuries old phenomenon. It's nothing new. It's the only thing new is that, you know, we're more visible. We're more, it's less of something we have to brush under the rug. I mean, a lot of people still do need to kind of hide that aspect of their history, but it's getting better.
So in terms of stories, does everybody have an individual story as to how they came to this place of transgender?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not only does everyone have their own path to a destination, but people have different destinations. I mean, there's people who, like myself, do a full physical transition. There are people who feel they identify with elements of both genders and they'll live their life that way without medical transition. Or there's some people that just don't feel the need for a medical transition, but they are living their life in a gender other than what they were assigned at birth. And, you know, different moments in our life as far as starting that journey, kind of, it's something we all kind of knew early in life, typically when you talk to people, and then different, we all have different moments of kind of understanding what that means, what, and how we go about that journey. So, yeah.
So part of the holiday, as I understand it, is recognizing some of the contributions that trans people have made, you know, to society at large. And so what are some of those things that we might be surprised to learn?
Well, if you use a computer that's smaller than a car, you owe that to the trans community. There's a Lynn Conway is the name of a computer engineer who made computer circuits incredibly more efficient. There's been a few other computer, like the Acorn microcomputer from the, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, that was primarily designed by a transgender woman. Tuberculosis screening, that was a transgender man who developed the current process of using x-rays to screen for tuberculosis. Outside of sciences, there's a lot of entertainers, particularly what I know from being a video gamer. A lot of classic, like 8-bit early Atari era games were designed by transgender women. So
as we take a look at the holiday as it's being celebrated right now, what are your hopes for it in terms of it developing in the next couple of years? Do you want it to get big, 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 or just to a point where it raises awareness and it's out there and people realize what it is?
I'd like to see it get to a big thing. I mean, there are a lot more transgender people than people realize. And we've done a lot for our communities. We've done a lot for the world. And there is a more more well-known holiday, Transgender Day of Remembrance, which does talk about, you know, the victims of violence. And I think that really only tells one part of the story. And having this day of visibility to really show not what the world has done to us, but what we have done for the world, for our communities, I think is a very important thing, a very important part of transgendered culture, of global culture.
So we've only got about 30 seconds or so left, and before we leave today, what is the one thing that you'd want our listeners to know about transgender people that they may not know now?
That we're just like you, you know? It sounds cheesy, but it's true.
Well, Catherine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Catherine Kimport, who is a member of the trans community and an LGBT activist.